disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
This is a DSSC special report. The Great American Plague. There are two people that I need to tell you about. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that you need to know about each of them. Phoebe Van Duren. Phoebe was born on January the 3rd, 1967 in Columbus, Ohio. She was an only child who had very few friends growing up. A quiet girl, though a straight-A student throughout her period of academia. She obtained a master's degree in psychology at the University of San Francisco in 1991 and boasted an IQ of 135. Perhaps boasted is the wrong word. Actually, Phoebe was way too introverted to boast about anything. After meeting her husband Derek in her final year of college, the two relocated to Ann Arbor in Michigan, where Phoebe got a well-paid job as a counselor. The second person I want to tell you about is Joseph Scott. Joseph was born on April the 17th, 1988, in Cardiff, South Wales. Joe gained a history degree at the University of Bristol in 2011. He never married, but from 2013 became a history teacher in a London high school. Joe had a sarcastic and cheeky sense of humour, and was very popular amongst his colleagues and had many friends. Both Joe and Phoebe had two things in common. Firstly, they were both acquaintances of mine, who I was very fond of. Two people I had huge amounts of respect for. On a professional level, they both excelled in their fields, were both very intelligent and warm people who commanded respect from colleagues and those in their respective fields of expertise. On a personal level, they were both incredibly kind, funny, and likable. People who lit up a room when they arrived. Both people that others wanted to talk to and be around when they were in their presence. The second thing they had in common was that they were both involved in a non-fatal car accident. In 1999, Phoebe was sat in traffic on the way to her job when a car ran into the back of her at around 40 miles per hour. The driver of the vehicle that hit her had undergone an epileptic seizure behind the wheel and had lost consciousness prior to the impact with Phoebe. Phoebe was able to walk away from the incident, but suffered with chronic whiplash for several months after the crash. A similar incident happened to Joe in 2017, when he was reversing from a driveway in heavy fog. Another car had hit Joseph's vehicle from the side, unable to see him in the treacherous weather condition. Joe suffered from a lumbar spinal injury as a result of the impact and went through mobility and stability issues over the following year. Following the injuries, Phoebe was prescribed by her doctor a course of OxyContin medication for her pain, whilst Joe was also given a prescription of OxyContin for the discomfort and suffering that he endured. OxyContin is just a brand name. The medication is essentially an opioid analgesic. Whilst the drug is prescribed by doctors to treat moderate to severe pain, it also comes with serious danger to the person taking them. OxyContin, amongst many other similar opioid medications, is extremely addictive, and continuous use and abuse can lead to tragic endings, which we'll come to shortly. The demand for opium is nothing new. It has attracted people in droves for thousands and thousands of years. With those droves also came commerce and crime, of course. Opium in its natural form comes from the natural latex resin that oozes from the bulb of the poppy plant, or Papaver seminiferum. It has been cultivated in vast quantities from as far back as the reign of Egyptian ruler King Tutankhamun, with records from the period referencing huge fields dedicated to its growth, which they then sold throughout the Mediterranean region. The ancient ruler of the Greek kingdom of Macedonia, Alexander the Great, expanded the opium market in 300 BC by introducing opium to India, where it is still cultivated by hand to this day. It's known for soothing pain, but with it comes the looming danger of desperate and immediate addiction, which we previously mentioned. During the Spanish Inquisition, Catholic clerics called opium the stuff of the devil. And by the 16th century, the resin was rolled into small black pills that were called stones of immortality. And they were also marketed as an over-the-counter painkiller called laudanum, a tincture containing multiple opium alkaloids. In the Victorian era, tincture of laudanum was cheaper to purchase than wine or gin, so addiction escalated in the lower and middle classes. The wife of US President Abraham Lincoln, Mary Todd, was a well-known addict of laudanum, as was Mattie Blaylock, the common-law wife of Old West lawman Wyatt Earp. Laudanum was thought of as so safe during the 19th century that it was given to infants during the days of the Industrial Revolution by their mothers who needed to leave home to work in the factories but had no childcare. By dosing their children with the medicine, it would ensure the child slept for hours upon hours until they returned from work. The smoking of opium also became popular in the 19th century and expanded into East China, where millions of citizens became addicted. The British East India Company would go on to build vast opium factories where the opium was rolled into large fist-sized balls and then shipped off to Chinese merchants to sell in their millions. The Qing Dynasty, who ruled in China at the time, attempted to stop the trade of opium, which led directly to the Opium War with the British in 1839, where the British went to war and defeated the Chinese for their right to free trade and to sell the Chinese opium. American commodity dealers like John Jacob Astor, you remember him from Titanic fame, and Warren Delano, grandfather of future President FDR, made a fortune by manufacturing opium in Turkey and smuggling it into the US. And by 1839, opium was the world's most traded commodity. Pharmaceutical morphine was introduced to the public in 1827 by the Merck Company when they launched a morphine-based cough suppressant under the brand name Heroin. The Merck Company, which is incidentally still a Fortune 500 company to this day, ranked at number 69 as of 2021, also introduced cocaine to treat sinus problems and also as an ingredient in beverages to boost energy levels. Other sources claim that Bayer, the German multinational pharmaceutical company, was the first to introduce heroin onto the market in 1895. I'll let you complete your research and arrive at your own answers on that one. Regardless of who it was to market the drug first, when addiction rates rose to dangerous levels, the United States made heroin illegal in 1924, creating a new global crime business dominated by the Italian mafia and Mexican drug cartel in the wake of the decision. Big Pharma turned to the mass manufacture of other opium products in place of heroin, like morphine and oxycodone, and learned how to mechanize the production process. They would create a demand for narcotics, addicting millions of men, women, and children, which in turn fueled the illegal drug trade. From pill mills to heroin dealers to illegal fentanyl factories, and the terrible truth is that the business of criminal cartels and pharmaceutical companies is connected. Together, they generate over $100 billion of income a year by cultivating and catering to a desperate need of opioids. That business model has a terrible cost. Within the last 20 years, more than 750,000 Americans have been killed by overdoses. So, I guess, opioid abuse and addiction has always been there, right? Always infected us. Well, not as it does in the form that we as a culture experience it today. Arguably, as a controlled substance, opioids do more damage now than they ever have. Opioid analgesics, although prescribed for pain relief, also tends to induce feelings of euphoria, relaxation, and reduced anxiety in those who are occasional users. In quantities above that prescribed, users report experiencing calm pleasure and neurological mania, which in turn triggers the human's incentive salience, thus making the euphoric feeling extremely addictive. If I can just throw some facts and data at you for a second. Drug overdose, and in particular opioid overdose, is the leading cause of death of Americans under the age of 50. Additionally, and this is quite staggering, more people have died from opioid overdose since 1990 than US soldiers died in combat in World War I, II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and the Iraq and Afghanistan wars combined. That's an incredible statistic. Just think how much money is spent fighting all of those wars combined, and how much money is spent on curing drug addiction. There you go. Further, Around 1% of the world has a drug addiction problem, with the United States being the nation with the highest number of addicts. Although it's not just a problem that the United States faces alone. Since 1990, there has been a 1,035% increase in drug overdose deaths in the United States. There has also been a 245% increase of drug overdose deaths in the UK, a 168% increase in Australia, a 39% increase in Germany, a 379% increase in Canada, 184% in New Zealand, 244% in Norway, and 271% in the Netherlands. All of these countries are experiencing the highest rates of drug addiction and drug addiction deaths in recorded history. My source for this data was the Global Burden of Disease study, which was conducted by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evolution and the Global Health Data Exchange. I think it's important to credit those guys. Thank you. It's almost impossible to research the subject of opioid abuse and the crisis that's silently ravaging the Western world without stumbling across one name in particular, however. Sackler. The Sackler family are one of the 20 wealthiest families in the United States. They're worth around $14 billion, according to Forbes Media Magazine and its editor, Randall Lane. The vast majority of that $14 billion fortune derives from the family's privately owned pharmaceutical company called Purdue Pharma. To quote the New Statesman, no other American family has made more money from the sale of controlled substances than the Sacklers, a family who have amassed a personal fortune of over $14 billion. Based in Connecticut, the firm invented and both aggressively and energetically marketed one of the most controversial opioid drugs of the 21st century, the aforementioned OxyContin. Since the 1990s, the prescription painkiller brand has been vastly overprescribed and abused, leading to millions of addicts, rising overdose deaths, a federal criminal case, and a tidal wave of lawsuits against the family and their organization, only now starting to play out in court. Most people, of course, will know the Sackler name from the family's philanthropic giving to arts institutions and elite academia, especially in the United States and the United Kingdom, where many museum galleries and university departments prominently and proudly display their family name. But let's start at the very beginning. Born in New York City in August 1913, Arthur M. Sackler was an American psychiatrist and marketer of pharmaceutical products. Born to a family of Jewish greengrocers who had emigrated from the Ukraine and Poland, Arthur was the eldest of three brothers. Arthur graduated from Erasmus High School and went on to attend New York University School of Medicine. Arthur would pay for his time at NYU and his tuition by working as a copywriter at William Douglas McAdams, a medical advertising agency. 5 years after leaving NYU, he would actually buy the same marketing company. Arthur would remain a key player in McAdams until his death in 1987. Under Arthur Sackler's guidance, McAdams massively transformed their organization and its methods, making it a medical marketing powerhouse. In 2019, Harvard University published comments to state that Arthur Sackler actually revolutionized and became a pioneering force in medical marketing, with great advances in techniques to implement direct sales to physicians and medical practitioners. Until Arthur Sackler came along, there had never been a strong marketing mind with a direct footing and in-depth knowledge of the needs and requirements of a practicing medical practitioner. Fun fact, it was through the tutelage of Arthur Sackler that then raw chemical manufacturer Pfizer transformed its business into that of a pharmaceutical mega corporation. That was done primarily with a switch of product to prescription drugs and also to the direct marketing methods that Sackler had created. Arthur Sackler's marketing strategies actually put Betadine, Cenaflax, Librium and Valium on the medicinal map throughout the 1960s. Throughout that same decade, he also created and published the Medical Tribune, a weekly magazine aimed at physicians that would go on to reach over a million doctors across 20 countries, and created huge influence within the medical industry, such as making Valium the first $100 million drug through its advertising, It's fair to say that Sackler was a money-making machine, a capitalist of vast experience and influence. What a guy. Arthur Sackler had a number of unusual businesses, however. He developed partnerships with the L.W. Frolic Advertisement Company and also MD Publications, where he was able to become editor of a number of medical publications and periodicals, further allowing him to push his opinion and influence in regards to his pharmaceutical business interests to a wide range of industry eyes and minds. Arthur additionally served as chairman of the board for Medical Press Incorporated and also president of Physicians News Service Incorporated, as well as the Medical Radio and TV Institute. His name and influence only grew over time, and he was extremely far-reaching in the medical and pharmaceutical world in regards to his opinion and influence. He served on the board of the trustees of New York Medical College, where he also held a position as a research professor of psychiatry. He joined the board of directors of Scientific American in 1985. That's all really rather marvelous for Arthur and his family, but so what? Well, in 1892, medical doctors John Perdue Gray and George Frederick Bingham started a pharmaceutical company which they named the Perdue Frederick Company. The company originally didn't aim to be groundbreaking in its field. Instead, it sold common medicines and treatments for earwax removal and laxatives, such as the common tablets Senecot. The company, who were based in Manhattan in New York, stayed much the same for a period of 60 years. That was until a powerful businessman in the medical field took notice of Perdue Frederick and thought he could build it into something bigger and better. In 1952, Arthur Sackler arranged the financing for him and his two brothers, Raymond and Mortimer, to purchase Perdue Frederick and relocate its headquarters to Yonkers in Westchester County, New York. Together, the three brothers changed the inner dynamic of Perdue Frederick as the Sacklers introduced Madison Avenue sales and marketing techniques to the promotion and selling of their drugs. The Sacklers had taken the groundbreaking techniques that Arthur had learned and evolved at his McAdams marketing firm and introduced them to Perdue. Quickly, however, Perdue would start crossing the line that separated promotion from fraud. Some of Perdue's early questionable techniques were to pay medical doctors large sums of money to pitch and or sell Perdue's products, falsely overstating their worth and benefit. The FDA were also paid off by Perdue in the 1960s to accept and promote the benefit of Perdue's products. The FDA, or Food and Drug Administration, whose job it was to protect the American public's health by ensuring safety, efficacy, and security in all public consumables. In fact, in medical drug trials, scientific pharmaceutical studies, and medical advertising, the Sacklers, on multiple occasions, were proven to have fabricated the names of doctors and physicians who had signed off on the safety and efficacy of their drugs. Patrick Radden Keefe, an investigative reporter and writer, uncovered the dubious practices of the Sackler family, but also noted that in the 1960s, the Sacklers, through Perdue, aggressively promoted Valium and Librium as everyday drugs that everyone should take to tackle common anxieties and stress. Following a massive increase in abuse and addiction to tranquilizers, a Senate committee was set up to investigate the Sackler's marketing and promotional techniques. When asked by the committee if the drugs he peddled were addictive, Arthur stated that they were not, and the problem was the people who used them. One of the drugs that Perdue marketed early on was a pill or tablet called MS Contin. It's essentially morphine sulfate with a protective layer or seal around the tablet that allows the morphine to release into the patient's bloodstream slowly and in a measured fashion over a period of time, roughly 12 hours. It's known as extended release. The Contin element of the name means continuous. It's used for cancer patients in the 1950s through to today. Well, in 1987, the patent that Perdue owned for MS Contin was due to expire, which would have impacted the company's finances. So the business began working on a drug that they could use to replace MS Contin and market as the market leader. Perdue chose to look at oxycodone, an opioid drug that had been around since it was invented in Germany in 1916. The drug is several times stronger than morphine and is perfect for treating moderate to severe pain in patients. What Purdue Pharma did with oxycodone was apply the Contin element of their MS Contin drug to oxycodone and create an extended-release pill that could treat pain over a larger 12-hour period. They called it OxyContin. The only downside of morphine, oxycodone, OxyContin, MS Contin, and all other opioids are they are hugely addictive. Many patients have reported of being heavily addicted after taking the drug only once. It was the release of OxyContin to the general public in 1995 that is the point of origin and the root cause of the current opioid epidemic. Of course, accidents can happen, and either through negligence or lack of awareness, many problems in history have snowballed through no one single person's fault. But what happened prior to the release of OxyContin was no historical accident. In fact, there is overwhelming evidence to support that a sinister crime had been committed in the name of profit. A crime which led to the addictions and deaths of millions of people across the world. You see, Purdue knew that oxycodone was a drug that was highly addictive and was of similar strength and worked the same way on the human body as that of illegal market heroin. Purdue also knew that whilst the risk of addiction was acceptable for those needing end-of-life care, that the market for those particular requirements was very small. Richard Sackler, the son of Raymond Sackler and CEO of Purdue Pharma from 2003 to 2018, wanted to market OxyContin to the widest possible market. And in the early 90s, he made it his sole task to do just that, working notoriously on an almost micromanagement basis in regards to the launch of the drug. Employees would state that you could call or email Richard in regards to OxyContin at any time, day or night, and he would immediately answer. Richard was aware that OxyContin was essentially a heroin tablet in slow-release form, but he also knew that the drug was easily manipulated and could be abused by it would allow the patient or individual to have legal heroin in powder form in their possession. In 1994, Purdue began the process of FDA approval of OxyContin for the relief of pain for everyday use and for almost everyone to take. Purdue played down the drug's addictiveness and also played down its ability to be abused, barely making those issues a footnote in their FDA document submission. Purdue, of course, knew exactly what to put in their FDA submission to enable easy approval. They knew this because they paid Curtis Wright, the FDA's medical review officer, to draft the approval document for them himself, in an act that was not just morally questionable, ethically below board, but also very illegal. Following Curtis Wright approving OxyContin on behalf of the FDA, after he himself helped create the application document with Purdue, Curtis Wright then joined the ranks of Purdue himself, where he received a $370,000 bonus in his first year of employment. OxyContin was given full FDA approval for use in low pain patients and was stated to have low to zero addictive qualities and could not be manipulated or abused. In fact, the draft submission stated that the drug would help reduce drug abuse. A line direct from the submission notes states, "The delayed absorption is believed to reduce the abuse liability of the drug."
There's no question that our best, strongest pain medicines are the opioids, but these are the same drugs that have a reputation for causing addiction and other terrible things. Now, in fact, the rate of addiction amongst pain patients who are treated by doctors is much less than 1%. They don't wear out, they go on working, they do not have serious medical side effects. And so these drugs, which I repeat, are our best, strongest pain medications, should be used much more than they are for patients in pain.
This audio was taken directly from a Purdue Pharma marketing video that was played for physicians in the late 1990s, encouraging them to prescribe OxyContin to their patients, with utter lies being communicated about the drug. In the late 1990s, Purdue would employ over 600 sales reps who banked $40 million a year in bonuses to aggressively market and pitch OxyContin to medical practitioners across the country. Using every tactic in the book, many of which that were questionable and lacked ethics, the sales team were trained to lie and manipulate doctors into prescribing OxyContin for all manner of pain in all ages of patients, from teenagers to pensioners, and for simple sprains and headaches right up to cancer treatment. Sales staff, it has been proven, knew that once the drug was prescribed, the user would become addicted and require more and more, which meant repeated sales and larger bonuses for them. But they were trained never to talk about its addictiveness. In fact, they marketed OxyContin as a pure opiate with no maximum dose and thus no chance of the patient overdosing. Additionally, they were told to market OxyContin as a drug with less than 1% chance of addiction. This is an excerpt from a Purdue sales staff training video from 1998.
Once you've found the right doctor and have told him or her about your pain, don't be afraid to take what they give you. Often, it will be an opioid medication. Some patients may be afraid of taking opioids because they're perceived as too strong or addictive. But that is far from actual fact. Less than 1% of patients taking opioids actually become addicted. And any drowsiness that might occur when you start to take the medication will soon wear off in most patients.
By the year 2000, OxyContin had become America's most used drug, passing Viagra and generating $1 billion per year in profit for Purdue. Between 1997 and 2002, prescriptions for OxyContin rose from 560,000 to 6.2 million, and to 255 million by the year 2012. Whilst drug overdose has traditionally been seen by authorities as an issue amongst minority communities or those of low income and means, by 2010 the opioid crisis had become a white middle-class suburban issue. It was at that point that the government decided to do something. In 2010, the US government, realizing that the crisis had hit fever pitch, decided to crack down on doctors who were overprescribing the drug. This act alone cut off millions of opioid users who had been legally prescribed pain medication, but who had now become addicted. Legal heroin use rose over 3,000% as those addicted tried to find alternative options of obtaining the medication that they were addicted to. In the years since the US government crackdown, we have seen the introduction to US black markets of illegally made fentanyl and carfentanyl, smuggled in from the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia. Fentanyl is 50 times stronger than heroin. Carfentanyl is 100 times stronger than fentanyl. There is no end to the epidemic in sight. Purdue Pharma is being sued by over 2,000 US cities and counties for its role in creating the opioid epidemic. They have filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. I wanted to make this special report and bring awareness to an ongoing plight in the Western world. My friends who I spoke about earlier, Phoebe and Joe, would almost certainly have supported me with this episode. Sadly, neither Joe nor Phoebe are with us any longer. Joe passed away in December 2020, and Phoebe sadly died 2 years before that in April of 2018. Their deaths weren't the direct result of the injuries they both suffered from their car accidents, but it was the car accidents that started the ticking time bomb toward their impending deaths. Both Joe and Phoebe sadly became addicted to their OxyContin prescriptions, and both sought larger and larger amounts from their doctors as their drug resistance increased. On April the 12th, 2018, Phoebe was found by her husband Derek, deceased and surrounded by her prescription medication. Her cause of death was OxyContin overdose and respiratory failure. Joe was found by his mother on December the 24th, 2020, on the floor of his kitchen with a heroin needle in his arm, suffering from advanced stage and untreated tetanus and with an eerie death rictus on his face. Drugs. You have won the war against you.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our newsletter over at DeadSoulSocialClub.com. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company, media, or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. Visit DeadSoulSocialClub.com for more information on how you can help us and support our broadcasts. Until next time, everyone, stay safe and sleep tight. And remember, stand firm as you enter the darkest night.